Beth, would you explain 120? I think it is in final form and ready to go, and so we'll bring it up. Senate Bill 120 first. It has been expressed before the committee at least twice, and you have the floor, Beth, just to tell us what we've done now here in final form.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Public Safety both have representatives here should there be any questions, but in essence, what has happened is we took the suggestions from last session, which included basically protections written into the law on what can actually be put on the network, and also access, so that both the Department of Public Safety and the court system are included in being able to get the information, and Senator Rohde's concern about doing automatic expungement in Section F of the bill basically says that as soon as practicable, after the date on which the minor is scheduled to complete the terms of probation, the Department of Public Safety shall expunge the information. So those are the changes. The departments have compromised and have no problem with the bill at this point, and I've checked the children's rules and can see no direct conflict with them, so that I think that we are that this is a reasonable form and committee substitute at this point for this bill, and it is Senator Fink's bill.
Does the Senator, the author, have any comment about legislation?
No, sir. Staff counsel did an excellent job.
I would entertain a motion to.
Which form are we looking at?
It is before us. I'd entertain a motion to put it out with the due pass recommendation. I think it will get that.
Senator, I would move that we move out the Judiciary Committee substitute for Senate Bill 120, dated 12288, with the due pass recommendation.
Without objection. The substitute was adopted, and it is going out with the due pass recommendation. The next item before us, in order, is Senate Bill 141. It's my understanding we are on teleconference. Beth, do we have people that wish to testify on 141 at this time? Senator Joseph's legislation, as he introduced the legislation, I should phrase. Senate Bill 141, please respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have Dr. Thorne present from the Department of Labor, and I think that she has very important testimony. On teleconference right at the moment, we have Mr. Catlin in Anchorage, who had expressed concern over the bill. Mark, excuse me, that is not the same Mr. Catlin. I apologize. We have a Mr. Catlin in Anchorage who is on, and then we have two other people, Mr. Christine and Mr. Andrews, who are due to call into the teleconference network. So we have one on, we have two we're waiting for on teleconference, and we have Dr. Thorne present and ready to testify.
And if I had, if Dr. Thorne could please come forward and give whatever comments he may wish to at this time. It's my understanding that industry and labor are working together on this bill to develop an acceptable measure to all sides. Dr. Thorne, you may identify yourself, and we are on Senate Bill 141, an act relating to hazardous painting certification, and we invite any testimony that we may receive.
Do I need to push the button?
Yes.
Push it forward.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I'm Dr. Annette Thorne, Medical Director of Occupational Health for the Alaska Department of Labor. The bill before you is an important bill for the protection of health of the public, as well as for employees in the state. Not only does the Department of Labor support the bill, but I as a professional must also support it. Because of the climatic conditions in the state, exotic, extremely toxic, and hazardous plants must frequently be used to protect against extreme temperature variations and moisture conditions. Hazardous paints are causing significant health problems nationwide that are of particular concern in this state. Painting of wood with paint containing wood preservatives such as pentachlorophenol has caused hospitalization of employees with toxic hepatitis in Alaska and has caused near death of painters from hypermetabolic effects of pentachlorophenol. This occurred in Bethel and is one example. Over six workers were unaware of needed protections and became seriously ill due to spray application of pentachlorophenol, which should not have occurred. A hotel was evacuated in Juneau because trimethylbenzene was spray applied as a varnish. Because of inadequate isolation and ventilation, this extremely toxic material got into the ventilation system, causing severe reaction among hotel guests, as well as 11 employees who had to be sent to the emergency room with pulmonary reactions. The manufacturers of the varnish stated that it should never have been used in spray applications. An extremely toxic paint containing isocyanates being sprayed on pipes in a construction site in Juneau was inadequately isolated, and though workers applying the substance were protected, an electrician nearby was inadequately warned and was exposed without protection. As a result, he not only developed a severe pulmonary reaction, which persisted for months, but his memory also became impaired, and this man who was normally extremely quick manipulator of facts and figures was unable to perform normal arithmetic and unable to safely perform his electrical work because of impairment of manual dexterity for over 6 months. He was very fortunate that he did not die because isocyanates can unpredictably cause sudden death from anaphylactic shock. One worker in the Anchorage body shop for cars developed sudden loss of consciousness from his reaction to the isocyanates and drove the car into the wall of the paint booth where he was doing his work. These workers often develop toxic liver effects as well as impairment of nervous functioning. Often these problems are not recognized by the painter himself, but is recognized by his family members, who note depression, irritability, personality, and memory changes. Or these are recognized by employers who note increased incoordination and propensity towards accidents or occurrence of accidents. I get frequent calls from physicians around the state inquiring about the chemical contents of paints and whether they can produce the effects that they are seeing. The employers and employees, in spite of right to know, have been unable to understand the severity of effects, these materials, and unable to discriminate as to which agents can cause the most severe reactions. For example, wood striping crews who use paint containing methylene chloride, this methylene chloride turns into carbon monoxide in the blood and can cause heart attacks and sudden death from carbon monoxide poisoning. The same road striping crew used paint containing lead chromate, which was not being removed from the skin and clothing before these employees went home. It was being taken home to their home environment to accumulate in their home environment. Many of these workers had toddlers at home who are extremely vulnerable at this age to the brain effects of lead. And these brain effects include slow learning as a result. Chromate is also in this substance, is a known carcinogen. One member of the painting crew that caused this investigation has died of leukemia, which is likely to be related to 20 years of paint exposure. The paints that he used had included benzene. The health effects of these paints are complex and require further training than just reading a material safety data sheet under Right to Know. It's important for people to have detailed training on how to handle these chemicals safely and which agents require extreme care, supplied air respirators, or biological monitoring, such as the case in lead exposure. We have found with asbestos certification that if employees are motivated by a complete understanding of the risk and by pride in their qualifications for certification by demonstration of hands-on proficiency, not only the worker, but the employer and the public benefit. The other workers on the site as well will be protected much better. There has been one death per year from carbon monoxide poisoning from uninformed use of compressed air among painters. In the last several years, the compressors overheat, resulting in burning of oil, lubricant in the compressor, and production of carbon monoxide. The workers were unable to remove the hood from their heads before they lost consciousness. This is due to the last death was December 27, 1986, in Kenai. This has been could have been prevented by proper maintenance and attendance of the compressors. There was also a recent accident that occurred August 8, 1987, when a worker was transferring paint and solvents from a 55-gallon drum to a 5-gallon can in an old machine shop. The paint and solvents were being transferred using a small metal spigot, and it took several minutes to fill a 5-gallon drum can from the drum. The worker apparently was trying to put out a cigarette when the fire started, causing both the can and the drum to explode. The worker died of burns that he suffered in the fire. You might want to take a look at. This would not have been seen in the workers' comp statistics as a paint-related injury. He died of burns. And it's very important to recognize the fact that our workers' comp statistics are imperfect for use in this situation. Half of the deaths reported on death certificates do not show up in our worker comp statistics. And you can well imagine that when illnesses are involved, there's much more problem with reporting to the workers' comp system. I have said little yet about the newly found brain effects of chronic exposure to routine solvents. These agents dissolve in the nervous system and accumulate there. Acute exposure causes reversible intoxication, which can cause accidents due to impaired judgment, coordination, and lightheadedness, and as well as dizziness. Though these effects wear off, repeated exposure causes evolution of progressively more irreversible brain impairment and damage. This includes sustained mood and personality changes, loss of interest in daily activities, irritability, fatigue, insomnia, and depression. With further exposure, this can lead into intellectual impairment, psychosis, memory loss, and dementia. These more severe effects are not reversible. In these individuals, CAT scans show loss of brain tissue, actually measurable on the CAT scan. These effects are being recognized more and more often and are beginning to take a toll on workers' compensation rates nationwide. This can and must be stopped. The cost in terms of lost work days, accidents, lost productivity, and further dependence on the state's welfare system can be avoided. The most effective way to avoid the consequences is to involve the worker through education and make the worker more able and motivated to take responsibility for his or her own protection. When the workers become more informed and cooperative, the social and economic consequences of an impaired workforce can be avoided.
Are there any questions, the witness, this time? Senator Joseph.
Thank you, Dr. Thorne, for an excellent statement. You mentioned that there is danger to the public as well as to the painter, and I think you gave, at least I tracked one illustration where the painter brings home lead materials which can affect his family. Mm-hmm. Did I miss other cases where the public, third parties are affected?
Yes, in situations like in the Baranoff Hotel where this trimethylbenzene was sprayed in the lobby, and the beautiful varnish you see there on the wood downstairs circulated through the whole ventilation system, the whole hotel had to be evacuated. That circumstance could have been entirely prevented. Of course, the 11 workers who were doing the spraying were the most affected. And they were the ones who had to visit the emergency room and receive acute care. But all the members of the public who were occupying the hotel had to leave and had more minor effects at that point in time. And in a way, the employee who was working at the work site was not employed at all by the same employer when he was out fixing the electrical conduits at the construction site. He was really a bystander who should have been appropriately protected by the workers who knew that they were dealing with a very dangerous substance, but did not understand the severity or the degree of the impact it may have on somebody who was exposed around the corner, so to speak.
I had an experience with Drano last weekend and frightened the wits out of me, so if I'm not coherent today, you'll understand what happened.
I wish I'd known that.
Today?
Those are examples of where the public can be affected. Now, in your experience or from the reading you've done, if the substance has dried after its application, does it carry any risk?
Yes. I don't know to the degree that we have this problem in Alaska, but in cities like Boston, New York, older cities, the residue that flakes off from aging paint, collects in the house dust, and lead poisoning is a severe problem, especially in inner city ghettos where the repair of the buildings is so poor. The children, especially toddlers, get on the floor and crawl around, get it on their hands, put it in their mouth, and their blood lead levels become very, remarkably high. But even though the levels are not the same levels you get in an occupational setting, they can discriminate learning impairment and and problems with their brain development as a result of those kinds of exposures. So the other thing is that certain paints that are applied when the building is reoccupied, if it's premature for the building to be reoccupied, can cause long-standing bronchial hyperreactivity, bronchitis, and so on in the occupants. It's very much like pesticides in a sense, mm-hmm. that there have to be appropriate periods of time for areas to be left vacant before they're reoccupied.
Senator Rohde?
Given the nature of the effects from the various chemical compounds that you noted, why are many of them on the market? We seem to have relatively strict government regulation, federal regulation, obviously, in some areas, but having a background in chemistry from college, it's, many of the things you mentioned are very dangerous or deadly. Why are they there?
Well, that's a question that's being asked more and more these days, and at a conference that I just attended last week, it was mentioned that in this area, workers in this country are functioning as hamsters and guinea pigs, in the sense that there is not pre-market, pre-introduction into the market testing of substances. We also have a long heritage of substances that have been used for long periods of time that are already on the market. It looks like the EPA may start doing more aggressive testing or requiring it. That's something that's just going to be on the legislative agenda in Congress, I think, in this coming year. But the fact is you're going to have chemicals that you cannot live without that are extremely toxic, like pentachlorophenol, or the derivatives from that are basically the same thing. Southeast Alaska would collapse under the water without pentachlorophenol on the wood that is used for piers and so on. It's a very powerful fungicide, and it's really not a replacement. It's not been found, an adequate replacement. And the same is true for benzene in certain industrial processes, chemical processes where you have to produce certain chemicals, you just have to use it. And this is why it's so incredibly imperative that proper protections and education occur for employees. They are the most exposed. A tremendous amount of money and attention is going towards exposure of the community and the environment. And levels that are not allowed for exposure for the community are allowed for employees because of the economic impact.
Any further questions at this time?
I'm going to touch on an area that I thought we might avoid today, but I think we'll proceed with it. You mentioned in your testimony that it's important that the workers have a sense of responsibility about their own physical well-being.
Yes.
And some critics of the bill say that it is weighted too heavily towards sanctions upon employers, and that there ought to be something in the way of a penalty or sanction to encourage good work habits by workers and to encourage them in the in their own training and understanding of these materials, either personally or for the department. Do you have a view as to that?
Well, I think that the bill as written has some powerful incentives for employees. First of all, if they are working on a job and are found not to be certified, they lose their job. And this is one of the most powerful incentives for employees not to complain to OSHA when they are having very significant exposures. It's the potential for losing their job. Jobs are scarce, especially in Alaska. And I think that's a very strong deterrent. Number two, employees pay the ultimate costs in terms of their health, their early demise, their inability to support their families, the fact that their families, in most of the cases where you have these chronic exposures and ultimate either cancer or severe disability, the families end up paying tremendously for that illness, far and above what any social system support is there. Workers' comp benefits are usually totally inadequate for the amount of economic detriment that the family suffers. So the workers, the employees, are paying themselves with their own health if these kinds of programs do not sensitize them to the importance of protecting their health. And I think that we've seen a tremendous change in the whole attitude and activity in asbestos handling in the state as a result of the asbestos worker certification. And a whole different sense of professionalism. And I think somebody who is going to testify today, Mark Catlin, heard him present a paper at the American Public Health Association, which discussed the changes in worker behavior as a result of asbestos worker certification in terms of smoking and in terms of use of respirators and so on. So I think that the sanctions are built into the system. I think that the whole basis on which OSHA is built puts the responsibility on the employer to set up proper work practices and provide proper protections, because workers are not in a position of power in this kind of situation. If they disagree with the way something is being done, they can leave the work site and not feed their family. So and reprisals are frequent in the work situation for somebody who complains to OSHA. So they're not in a particularly powerful position. And this is a reason, given the fact that the employers do have this power of removal of a paycheck, it seems appropriate to place the responsibility for the employer to do something so simple as check for a card. It's being done in other settings, and it's not really a time-consuming kind of thing to have to do from my perspective. And I think that in exchange for that, the employees suffer much more severe repercussions if they are not certified.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there further questions, the witness? You may wish to join us for the subsequent testimony on this bill. At this time, is Mr. Mark Catlin online in Anchorage?
Yes, I am.
You may proceed. Please identify yourself for the record, Mark. If you wish to testify, we would be happy to have you at this time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and the rest of my committee members. My name is Mark Catlin. I'm an industrial hygienist with the Alaska Health Project based here in Anchorage. We're a private nonprofit group that provides assistance in occupational safety and health issues to both employees and employers throughout the state. We've been doing that for the past 8 years. We also view this piece of legislation as a very important matter. I think that there is a definite need for the training because of the hazardous materials that most workers encounter in their work on construction sites. Dr. Thorne did a wonderful job of summarizing a lot of the health hazard information, and I will just eliminate that part from my testimony. I have a few additional anecdotes, and we use anecdotes because of the poor quality of the occupational illness data here in Alaska and nationwide. But the anecdotes of problems that have shown up that I have dealt with, and some of the same ones that Dr. Thorne has dealt with, show up in my door. But there are a case that I can recall within the last year of a painter applying paints in a construction job to enlarge an office building, and the paints they were using entered the ventilation system of the existing office building that's still occupying. The building had to be evacuated here in Anchorage. Had to be evacuated for an entire day. Several of the clerical workers could not come back to work on doctor's orders for several days. One woman was out for several weeks. That was something that could have been avoided had the contractor involved reviewed the data sheet, been aware of the ventilation problems that potentially could have occurred, and scheduled the work at a different time, or made efforts to control the pain exposure to other people. In this operation, they were protecting their own employees, but they were not taking consideration of how this might affect other people. Another case that I will never forget is discussing getting a call one afternoon from a person who was a painter at a company here in Anchorage that maintained aircraft, small aircraft, and he was working with a new type of paint that turned out to be an isocyanate-containing paint. He gave us the wrong type of respirator to use, and to do his work, he was required basically to take a deep breath, run inside the aircraft, spray as long as he could, run outside, take another deep breath, and run back in. And we worked both with him and his employer trying to rectify the situation. It's very difficult to get the employer to accept the fact that this paint was as hazardous as it was. These are just two examples of numerous ones, I think, that all occupational health professionals run into here in Alaska dealing with these very hazardous paint products. There is a, there's been a real change in painting materials over the past 15, 20 years. They're a lot more toxic than they used to be, and I don't think that both the workers and employers have really gotten up to speed on how toxic these materials are and the precautions that need to be taken. And so the reason for, or because of those reasons, and because for most of the materials that are covered by the Occupational Health Standards of the Department of Labor, there are not specific training requirements. For some there are. For things like asbestos, we have specific training requirements. For very few other hazardous materials, there are specific training requirements. This type of training requirement for painting hazardous materials would cover a broad spectrum of toxic organic solvents, isocyanates, and other things that Dr. Thorne mentioned. Dr. Thorne also mentioned that I think that a number of us can look at the success of the asbestos abatement certification program that was debated down in June 3 years ago and has now been in effect for about 2.5 years. There was a lot of initial skepticism that training program would be very difficult to put on, that it would not be well received by both workers and employers, and I think that the history of that has shown that to be completely wrong. I think that it's done wonders to improve the quality of work in the asbestos abatement industry. As Dr. Thorne mentioned, there's a real sense of professionalism among people who do asbestos abatement these days. And as she mentioned, the Alaska Home Project has been assisting with several asbestos abatement training courses for the past 2.5 years. Specific one with the laborers union here in Anchorage. I'm the supervising industrial hygienist, Century Clark. Last year, we wanted to see in some measurable way what effect the training was having on the employees. Were they actually using the information? How were they improving their work practices? We had a sense from observations in the field and discussions with contractors and employees that the training programs were having a very positive effect. The results of our survey indeed did show that people who had been to the program and been out working had much more positive work practices and health behaviors than those people who had done asbestos abatement previously to the certification. There were far fewer people who were smoking, which was a very important issue in terms of asbestos exposure. There were double the number of people who were discussing with their own personal physician the fact that they were working with asbestos, and there was a dramatic change in other work behaviors on the work site, checking for air monitoring, use of respirators, doing other types of appropriate work practices to try to reduce exposure to asbestos to people doing the abatement and to those people outside the abatement area in the ambient surrounding areas, such as schools or other public buildings. We did present that paper at the American Public Health Association meeting in New Orleans several months ago. We now have it out for publication. And we've got a number of requests from around the country on the success of, for more information on the success of the Alaska certification training program. 3 years ago, Alaska took a giant step forward in terms of training with asbestos. I think that we can duplicate the successes from the asbestos training program here with this type of training program that would cover these very hazardous materials that is faced by people in the paint industry. I think I will just stop at this point and take any questions if there are any. I would just urge you to support this bill. I think it's very important, very timely, and the Health Project is going to continue to support this legislation. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions of Mr. Catlin?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it occurs to Mr. Catlin, you may have some comment about this, but if this bill were implemented, and I'm really talking through you to our friends in AGC, it seems to me that the employer gets out of it a worker who is paid for his or her own training, who will be a safer worker in the workplace with reduced exposure to compensation and just better work habits generally. Is that the analogy to the asbestos program you were trying to make?
I think very much so. There have been a wide variety of organizations that put on training for the asbestos program, a number of the unions that have been involved, and a number of private laboratories and other training centers that have been charged a fee. Now, there are a number of workers who have paid the fee so that they're qualified to work in their trade, and that would, I'm sure, happen with the paint bill. There have also been a number of employers who have taken it upon themselves to want to have a very well-trained workforce, and they will send their employees and pay for their attendance at these courses and keep them current with the training requirements. And I suspect very strongly the same thing will happen with this bill if it passes.
Are there further questions? If not, I think in the same drop is Mr. Jerry Christine, who may wish to testify. If he is, why please identify himself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Christine. I represent Painters Local 1140 Anchorage, Alaska. We're very grateful for the expert testimony of the previous two witnesses that very accurately and eloquently testified to the need for this bill. Well, one of the things that I've had experience with, and I wanted to relate this to the members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, is that our members sometimes become sensitized to the very material that they must work with to earn a living. And can you imagine the effect that the emotional and really bad effect it would have on a person to have worked and to have learned and got some apprenticeship and training and to have worked, say, at a trade for 20 years and really getting almost to the peak of your trade in your terms of your earning capacity and satisfaction that we all get to doing a job and learning from a doctor that the very material that you must work with to earn a living in that field, you're sensitized to, and you cannot do it any longer. I don't think that problem is confronted by many people in their occupation. It is a problem for the painters. So, this is another illustration, actually, of the just the dramatic effect that some of the materials that we must work with have on our people. The chairman, question has been asked and a proposition put forward fairly often by some members of the committee and others that the employees, asking that the employees be penalized as well as the employers. Well, I think the one thing that we not forget is that by and large, the employer absolutely controls the workplace. It's his job. He directs the workforce, right, to work. How many and under what conditions, essentially. And so I think that's a factor that ought to be taken into account in this discussion about employees being penalized. And in addition to that, Mr. Chairman, although I do not have the precise language to suggest, that the possibility exists that maybe we could do something about the penalty that is imposed upon the employer by this legislation. Possibly we could reduce the amount, and possibly we could, in conjunction with that, I would suggest that maybe we could change the definition about which applies to a violation. Maybe a violation could be construed as one employee or each employee on each job could be construed as one separate violation. And if that would be an acceptable proposition, maybe we could reduce the amount with $1,000, say $200.
Could you repeat that last statement if I'm not really breaking too much into context as a whole?
Well, not at all. I'd be happy to, but maybe the possibility might exist that we could, in the definition of what a violation was, that it could be construed to mean that a violation would be a separate violation would be each employee a project on a job, and if that would be an acceptable proposition, then maybe we could lower the amount to as little as $200 per violation, and that way a small employer obviously would have less exposure to a penalty, and a large employer possibly would have more. But anyway, that's we're looking for some compromise that would enable this legislation to go forward and be acceptable to those that don't presently support it wholeheartedly. And so I just offer that up as a suggestion, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Josephson seems to seek floor two at this moment. Please proceed, Senator.
Thank you. I think, Jerry, that part of that was done in the State Affairs, I mean, in the Labor and Commerce Committee version, which speaks of $200 for the first violation. Someone's shaking his head after I'm reading.
$1,000.
No. Committee substitute, I'm talking.
Yeah, $1,000. It's on page 3, line 8, Labor and Commerce CS.
No. I have a work draft in front of me that says $200. Okay, all right, okay. Okay, all right, I'm previous here. There is a draft of that. There is a draft of that. There is a draft of that proposal, which provides a $200 fine for a first violation and up to $1,000 for a subsequent violation.
That would be.
And your point is that you just like to make sure that if there are a set of workers, each one would be considered a separate violation, right?
That should be correct. That the definition of what a violation would be a per employee.
Okay.
Are there? Oh, you may proceed, Mr. Chris. You may proceed, Mr. Christine, and to.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that. Rick concludes the remarks that I wish to offer, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to respond. I want to point out to committee members, however, that I'm having trouble with this bridge. If I can't hear you, I really mean it.
All right. I presume that's the noise from the paint machinery rather than from the paint. Are there any questions of Mr. Christine at this time, or Mr. Catlin, who's still there? There seem to be none there. Do we proceed to another bridge? You may wish to stay on. I think maybe the committee will continue for some period yet. Are there questions? Are there people here now? I see two people have signed in. Mr. Richard Arab, do you have more to add at this time? You're here for just answering questions. And there's one other person that signed up, Risa. If you identify yourself and whom you're with, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Risa Gerald, and I have a new title this year. I'm Director of Government Relations for Associated General Contractors.
All right.
But when they told me that, I said, please send money, keep the title. Basically, last week, Mr. Horace Hunt with Brown and Root gave my testimony. He wanted to see what I had testified previously, and he basically gave my testimony. That's the reason I didn't testify last week, that under the workers' right to know law, there is training program that is required. To confirm what Senator Kurtulba said earlier, we are attempting to get into negotiations with the painters' unions to see if we can't come up with some compromise. Mr. Pat Smuts with the AFL-CIO is trying to make contact with certain people. One fellow is traveling at the present time. And they are all going to get together with Phil Snyder of our staff in Anchorage, who used to be our safety director, who's now our executive director. And he's quite knowledgeable about all these chemicals and all the nuances, and see if we can't come up with a compromise instead of us testifying against safety legislation, which we have a heartburn with, but we also don't want to have legislation that's onerous on our contractors.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Rohde, you have the floor.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to assist us, the FLC and the AGC get together. Having my father was a painter for 40 years. I've been both a contractor, and my first job in construction was as carrying paint pots to 10 years old, and I know something about it as well as having some technical information. And I understand the AGC's position, with regard. To the penalties, and of course, I think I understand the concerns of those people who are actually painting, and I'd be happy to work as a subcommittee, both for technical assistance and any other kind of practical assistance on the bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Rohde. Yes, I knew your father very well, tremendous fellow, and I also know that he was a long-time member and activist in painting. Senator Joseph, do you have some comments? You are the author of this bill. I understand that that there is an attempt and that you are involved in this attempt to perhaps define the legislation here so the next committee of reference does not choose to have to do so.
Well, Senator Fix was a painter also, she told us, but I don't know whether her exposure was more severe than mine to Drano or how we could compare with that. I think she was using latex paint and she's okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm all for this process and I appreciate your you know, forwardness in trying to work out some agreement. I'd like to kind of keep a short time frame on this process, and would it be doable to report back to us a week from today as to if or not something like that can come up?
Sure.
I would appreciate the opportunity to take the bill up at that time and get a progress report, either vote it up or down.
It's certainly not the position, and I don't believe it's the position of the majority of the committee, to delay this process here. If we can't resolve it, then the next committee reference presumably will have to, because I can see a rather full load of judiciary when we meet 2 days a week. And but if we could resolve it here, it would please me. Senator Rohde is very willing to be brought into this loop, Senator Josephson, and you continue to act as a committee, subcommittee one on this matter.
Oh, I'll call on Senator Rohde.
And Senator Rohde. At this time, then, we will recess this portion. No further testimony? Is there further testimony? Thank you. Do you wish to contribute something this time, Beth? Counsel.
No, I was going to say that I had checked with legal services and have read the right to know law myself and have done a comparison between the two, but I think that I'll just save it and put out a written memo so that members can have it in their files and know exactly what the differences are and why the department sponsor feels it's necessary to have this, and I can also reflect on it next session. If we can, we need to have just a minute's recess for the committee so that the next bill can be prepared.
At this time, then, we'll recess this section of the meeting and we'll go on to the next bill, which is Senate Bill 276 by Senator Fahrenkamp, and we'll be in recess for 5 minutes or less.
Bill Clark, you're related to Bill.
Does he?
Yeah, he says there's all kinds
of things.
Senator Farenkamp, and introduce legislation. Committee substitute Senate Bill 276 is before us. I do see information here from the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board that says that they are not, they do not object, but they do approve, in fact, of the legislation, now that I read it again. Do we have a witness? You may come forward. Please identify yourself.
And if I might break in before Mr. Moyer, Mr. Chair, we are waiting for the committee substitute. The drafter is getting it straight to us, but Mr. Moyer can describe the changes from the original bill for the committee so that they know that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tom Moyer from Senator Farenkamp's staff. And the changes in the CS, which we'll soon receive, I think reflect some of the concerns brought up at the last meeting. The first change would be to the title, which would narrow it from the broad title it was to an act relating to brew pub, brewery, and beverage dispensary licenses and prohibited financial interest in a licensed liquor business. Another change to be made, you might recall we talked about the archaic wine gallons. Well, that was the advice of the drafter to leave it in. Well, Tam Cook decided, the director, that they may as well take it out at this point. So you'll see in the CS,
this is the one they're going to amend.
Deleted from the statutes. Yeah, if it would be of any assistance, I do have an earlier draft. Penny is not seeing that. You can follow along.
You wish to express yourself on the original bill now? Is that what we're talking to with amendments? Or
to the draft?
Or to the draft?
The draft. We'll Xerox this. I apologize.
All right.
What's the date of the draft?
Beth, what's the date of the draft just now?
118. Does everyone have it?
No, I have a 114. Yeah.
No, okay. Let me go Xerox this. At least we'll be able to follow it correctly.
Very good.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I know it's not the purview of this committee, but the Department of Revenue's fiscal notice is zero, and if they're going to sell a license, I don't understand why there isn't a show of revenue here, and if they're going to a paper? What are they doing? They're not reprogramming. They're not. There's nothing. It's a zero fiscal note, and I would think at best the fiscal note's incomplete or not reflective of the actual departments. The
Department of Revenue have
a
comment.
Oh, there he is. How are you?
Just fine.
Please speak to that while we're making up our mind whether we're going to Xerox copies or we're going to continue this hearing.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Royce Weller. I'm with the Department of Revenue. Fiscal note does reflect zero. I know that, as Senator Pace was referring to, in Section 3A and Section 3B, a brewpub license fee is $250. And ABC Board didn't actually, Pat Chirac, Executive Director, didn't know how to project that. In fact, how many brewpub licenses may be out there. I'm sure it may generate maybe $1,000 or $500. He didn't feel comfortable with making that projection. If the committee would like, I mean, we can.
What you're saying is minor, insignificant, inconsequential, but it's something.
It is something. That's correct. It's just, it's probably.
Yeah, of course, Senator.
Just for future, then, under here where it says analysis. If a statement to that effect could have been put in there, it would just save, it would be clarification, and it would save the question and for you having to come to the table.
Thank you.
Insignificant, but, well, it would be an embarrassment on the floor of the Senate if this hadn't come up, because everybody likes to find something to bite into.
There's your person.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We'll do another fiscal note.
Put that in
now.
I bet you the Finance Committee's
going to
ask you anyway.
Yeah.
I'll be right back.
Thanks, Beth.
If the committee's interested, I mentioned last time some research I did in Chicago. This is what typically a brew pub would look like. Just pictures in there.
Mr. Chairman, just a question. I note on the second page of the outline, it appears that the brew pub licenses will be licenses that will not be able to be transferred or will not be owned by somebody. Is that a correct statement that they'll just be an adjunct to a beverage dispensary license?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roy, that's correct. The in order to get a brew pub license, you have to have already had a beverage dispensary license, and they could only be transferred in tandem. You couldn't just transfer the brew pub license.
What I'd like to avoid is the position we've gotten ourselves in with a number of licenses where we've essentially put people in monopolies, not unlike the old East India Company, and allowed them to perpetuate those monopolies at public expense. And then we've got to give licenses as they originally intended licenses, and then of course they run that business for as long as they wish, and then a new license is granted if they're applicable to the next person that wants to operate that business. Giving the licenses value has, I think, produced a whole host of problems. And certainly, you know, while it may be impossible to undo that now, we certainly in the future ought not to allow that to happen.
The whole liquor thing is a big problem.
Mr. Chairman, maybe the committee would like to look at this. In Arizona, they phased out the reselling of liquor licenses over a 10-year period of time. They passed a law that said this license is only good for 10 years, or until this date, 1987. And each year, of course, they slowly lost in value. But then once you're going out of business, you turn your license back into the state, and the state issues a license to the next person on the list or who qualifies. And that then took the escalation of liquor licenses and the perpetuation of that out of the system totally. And it took 10 years to do it, so it wasn't an extreme economic hardship to those in the business. They were able to relate to it. And I thought about trying that in this state, or at least, yeah, and it goes
along. There are several licensing, women's entry, and so on, that people have great wonder whether they shouldn't return to the state after the users.
Fishing and fishing.
Yeah, fishing in particular, we've seen our industry go out of state now.
Well, that's right.
50% or something already. Yes.
We should turn the licenses back into the state, because then
it is public property.
Yeah, that's right.
We are public, a public right.
We recreate instant wealth there, but we do a disservice at least to the next generation.
Well, right, to the youngsters.
Yes. Let's remember that when we get our mariculture licenses, that we don't create
big
economic benefit for somebody.
Write to me in Palm Springs or wherever. Yes, sir, you may proceed.
Well, in that regard, Senator Bernkamp considered a value question too, and I think that's why she concluded she did want to see the brew pub license itself be sold. For instance, if a bar who had a brew pub decided he wanted to get out of the brew pub business, to keep the bar, he'd indeed have to turn the license back to the state. But if he were going to sell the whole kit and caboodle, he would be authorized to do that under this bill.
Before us at this time now is the first 26th, 88 suggested amendments that occurred, and you have already testified to this, but would you repeat your testimony on the changes now that we have this bill before us?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, again, the title, as you can see, has been narrowed considerably. And then in section 2, on line 14, the word wine gallons has been deleted as per the Sam Cook suggestion, archaic language. In section 3, the difference between this version and the previous one is we've reversed the 1 and 2, figuring that you ought to brew the beer before you sell it. It just made more sense to speak to the manufacturer of it first and try to make it more clear that the beer would have to actually be brewed on the premises of the where the beverage license is. Make no doubt that they must take place in the same place. And then I believe that's the only differences. I'm sorry, line 27. On the transfer, as I was just speaking, Senator Rhodey, the transfer would be prohibited unless both licenses would be transferred.
I might force a stronger statement, a statement in the law that this license is different than, this might be a place to start, that this license is different than other licenses in that it is a real license, it's not a monopoly, and does not go with anything and belongs to the state. Goes and comes back.
You want a statement?
This might be a good place to start it because nobody has a vested interest.
Would you write that preamble, Senator Rhodey, and give it to Beth at your convenience? Shortly, though.
Mr. Chairman, I believe there was a question, too, on the sanitary inspection, Senator Bridge.
Yes, that was a question I had, too, right?
Yes, I spoke both to the board and the DEC. And the board normally inspects breweries and would inspect brew pub annually. And if they found something that looked amiss from a sanitary point of view, they would then call DEC, who on their own inspects bars annually. And in the course of doing that, would also look at the brewery. But DEC would basically be checking for contamination, the health-related aspect of beer, using what they call good manufacturing practice standards.
So they would they just do this annually?
That's right.
You know, dairy facilities, there is a real host of bacteria in brewing materials. Dairy facilities, probably every 30 days you can expect somebody to come running through, and much more often in the processing plant. Obviously, it's a larger plant handling a lot more. I wonder, has anyone in DEC or anyone that's got public health background testified as, or do other states just do it the way we would be doing it once a year?
I don't know about the other states. And
I think it'd be worthwhile checking. We might just open up a host of potential problems here.
Mr. Chairman, that was my question on the 250, whether
Excuse
that's
me.
Enough, because I think it's... is going to be more than once a year, just, and they're looking for a different thing. Those people are not necessarily, I mean, they're looking for all the health standards. I don't know if they're particularly trained to do this kind of inspection.
Then we need a DEC fiscal note.
Yeah. I put through a piece of wine legislation one time. Believe me, you're not being harassed. It takes a lot of time and effort, and we still didn't cover all bases. Mm-hmm. That was wine manufacturing, which is now a statute. So I think probably if you will find out if DEC can sign off on this, what the cost inspection should be and how many times they may need to inspect it in other states to do this, we could tell them quickly. We probably ought to have that. We may need to amend this. This may be able to come out just as it is. I hate to be too much, but we haven't had that long either. I think we better do that.
I'd be glad to. There's
public health policy probably requires it. And if we don't do it, some other committee will pick it up in any way.
It is a new area, brew pubs. Yeah. There's only a couple other states that are doing it, but it's probably a good time to see how they're doing.
Get the floor.
Tom, could you explain in the first page in line 15, what are you accomplishing by adding or in another state or country?
Well, if you read that section literally, it says a brewery license authorizes the holder to sell beer in quantities more than 5 gallons to persons licensed to sell beer under this title. And the board looked at that and said, well, that really means that, for example, Chinook Brewery can only sell beer, a wholesaler, to a person licensed under this title, and someone in the state of Washington, of course, is licensed under our title. And therefore, technically, Mr. Larson couldn't sell beer in Washington, Oregon, or Japan, or Canada, places he's looking to market.
So the brew pub...
Oh, but this has nothing to do with the brew pub itself. It's just in the same statute.
We're just correcting.
So we're just correcting that oversight.
I wonder what implications there are. This simply allows us to export this.
Exactly.
Well, if there are no further questions, I think those are significant to the next meeting. We'll bring this material before us. We can bring it up on a very short notice. We'll recess this portion. At this time, I do appreciate the hard work that you put into it in the meantime in the Senator's absence. We have a letter from the, on another subject. We have a letter from the Attorney General in response to Senator Gosin's letter stating his concerns with the ownership and operation of Pacific Marine Insurance Company. I think that's fairly important for everybody to have a look at. There's a lot of fishery, as I remember it from last summer, and there was a casual inquiry of me with a concerned consul. There's a lot of our people are insured with this company, and apparently a whole lot of hull insurance and so on is in some question if this company goes down. It may be of interest to members individually or the committee follow up after. I wish Senator Joseph was here, but he gave me a letter, and I turned it over to the AG, as I remember, and so on. But it is I think it's a real concern that may require
What does it mean that the company is now in rehabilitation? Does that mean it's declared bankruptcy?
Restructuring, actually, essentially kind of Chapter 11.
There were a couple of out of country.
Never referred to that as rehabilitation. I mean,
that's insurance that maybe because of our antique insurance statutes.
Yeah, they were very worried that we were being set up, and I think we could have been. Maybe this has stopped at the various quarries over the summer, but this was a wholly owned subsidiary, as I remember, of a company that may have had holdings like Vesco out of the country in these small Caribbean islands. Money was moving around, and insurers and the insured were maybe at total risk. And apparently they were the only people that really insured a lot of the hulls that maybe the state made the loans on. And it got fairly nasty, and this is the first response. I have yet to read it myself, but I appreciate Beth bringing it for us. For another meeting, we might want to comment after we've read it. Another item is last year I had a subcommittee that was very effective on the revisor statute. As I remember, Senator, the vice chairman, Senator Sturzelewski, chaired that with Senator Rohde.
Senator
Joseph. With Senator Joseph. Do you wish to be on the revisor statute subcommittee, Senator Rohde?
The chairman have something against
another
him?
One?
Yes, I thought you would chair this revisor statute. It's not near as heavy as it was last
That's
year.
Good to know.
And I know Senator Rohde's going to want to work on a horizontal legislation that's going to come before us before long, like a thundering.
Horizontal property regime?
Yeah.
What about tort legislation?
That has. Excuse me?
The tort legislation? Are you about to read something about that?
Yes, not long. We're working our way down the list.
Really?
We don't call it horizontal property regime anymore.
Something else. Well, she is
Iowa, Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act.
Oh, and incidentally, going back, I'm off.
Do you have to keep the chairman abreast in these latest developments?
Senator?
I'm seriously thinking of holding a hearing on torts in Anchorage because we had a lot of people on both sides that wanted to testify. And I hate to hold meetings in Anchorage, in Palmer, or in any other place, but I'm seriously considering it with as brief as is possible notice. So,
would you please let us know a date?
Okay.
Yes,
yes,
yes
would, sir. It would be probably on the Friday or Saturday of the second week then of February. And we intend to wind that bill up.
The 13th is the second week.
What is it?
The 12th and 13th.
Yeah.
It's Friday and Saturday of the second week.
They were on teleconference, and we had two meetings of substance last year, and a whole lot of people didn't get to testify.
He did it on Monday instead of Friday, and we should have caught that because we should have taken the 19th.
Oh, it's possible.
The day of exit of the bill rather than the day of hearing.
It's possible to teleconference from that end so that members could participate here, but I definitely want a quorum of the committee before I go up there because we're not going to go up there without a quorum to observe, listen, smell, and taste. We'll do it down here if we don't have a quorum. We have that request.
Jackets issued to members of the committee.
Ms. Chairman,
yes.
Since you seem to be going along at a great rate here, am I, along with Senator Josephson, am I the chairman of a subcommittee to come back on this exciting bill?
You are.
All right. And
the bill is yours.
Thank you.
And you bring it back at your...
I noticed that in this information on Pacific Marine Insurance that we are getting some advice as to some changes that are needed in the legislation. I hope that we listen to that if we've got a problem. And maybe the committee could prepare some rectifying legislation.
I feel that that's the subject for the next meeting. Mm-hmm. All right, that's the reason I wanted to give you the letter. I just kind of perused it and I thought, oh boy, we'd better look at this one.
And we're looking at a meeting in Anchorage, maybe on the 12th or thereabouts.
Yes, that is right. We'll look at the calendar and what conflicts you may all have, and the others will. Those that wish to have a position before the committee will be there. There is no doubt about that on fairly short notice.
Mr. Chairman, let me read this to you as my initial sentence before we adjourn the meeting with regard to the brewpub license, and I would add a section on the first page of the bill, section C, that would say, the brewpub license is not transferable, comma, shall remain the property of the state of Alaska and is not subject to any form of alienation.
That's wonderful.
That is an amendment that has been adopted without objection.
You just sound like an attorney.
I kind of like that. You write good law.
But it's interesting. Why not? It's a privilege, so why not?
All people of the state of Alaska.
And it may start something, as you said. But for 25 years, I've been trying to get the state to select the gravel along known routes. in advance so that we don't have to buy it back as the roads go through or as they continue, and I still can't get to do the tangerine. I hustled Cheryl the other day and said, Cheryl, we've done all the work by the camp.
You've been hustling Cheryl for years.
She keeps saying no.
Now you're hustling Max and Jens. I hear about it.
Oh, I love them.
Almost daily.
Just touch. No, I really am. They're old and valued friends. We all
I think I'll adjourn.
After all, I know they are pros, and so do you. You're no worry over them, unfortunately.
You got that, huh, Rick?
You got that.